Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
You are listening to Crawl Space on the Crawl Space Media Network. If you like this show, you'll love Missing, which is also hosted by us.
Missing started as Missing Maura Murray, and now it continues raising awareness for all missing people. And we also have an entire network of shows you'll love. Check them out at crawlspace-media.com.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I couldn't be better, Tim. If I was any better, I'd be you.
Well, Lance, I'm doing great today because we're speaking to our buddy Andrew Dodge of Unforbidden Truth. And his podcast, Unforbidden Truth, is now joining the Crawlspace Media Network. And if this name sounds familiar to you, well, it should, because he has been a part of the Crawlspace Media Network previously with his show Criminal Perspective that he and Chris Duet started several years ago. And now Andrew is back with Unforbidden Truth.
And I gave him a little bit of a hard time about this rift between himself and Chris Duet that actually is not the case. They do not have a rift. They get along very well. Criminal Perspective went in a direction of speaking with survivors and victims' families, as people who listen to the show know. And Andrew Dodge has a real talent with getting these interviews of convicted serial killers, mass murderers, etc. And that was the direction he wanted to go in. So the two hosts kind of split off and doing different versions of what Criminal Perspective started off as. And it's a really interesting dynamic that Andrew has with these people that he writes with, he visits, he interviews, and he just has a real knack with this sort of thing.
Okay, and we're going to play a couple of clips in this interview. Listener discretion is advised. Make sure you subscribe to Unforbidden Truth. There are links in the show notes.
And check out all of our fine shows at crawlspace-media.com. And also follow that Twitter account now, at Crawlspace Media.
Welcome to the Crawl Space Podcast, Andrew Dodge of Unforbidden Truth. What is going on?
Oh man, not a whole lot. Just trying to stay busy and keep shit rolling.
Well, no, you're totally being disingenuous there when you say not a whole lot. You have been doing quite a lot, including branching off and having your own show, the great Unforbidden Truth. And you've been busy producing these episodes and coming up with some really great interviews. And I want to talk all about that. And I know people want to hear about these interviews, but I want to get the proverbial elephant addressed, which is the intense rivalry and just sheer, I don't want to go so far as to say loathing you have between Chris Duet and yourself, but I feel like we got to talk about this rivalry that's happening now.
A rivalry?
I'm totally kidding. I think what's the so you used to be a part of Criminal Perspective, and now you're doing your own thing. Is there a rivalry? Is it like a Yankees Red Sox thing now?
Yeah, just dish. Spill the tea.
Dish.
No, there's no rivalry. Chris and I are still on good terms. I guess long story short, the reason I went my own way is I wanted to basically branch off and do my own thing, and I wanted to incorporate new things with the show that I guess we could say was creative differences. But as far as I know, Chris and I are still on good terms. We speak every once in a while. There's no rivalry, no beef, anything like that of the sort that I'm not aware of, at least.
I was totally kidding. He actually speaks very highly of you. He supports what you're doing wholeheartedly and wishes nothing but the best for you. And it'll be great to see the two of you if we ever get you on like a Get Vocal or something. That'd be fun. But it's good to hear on your end that you had a certain direction that you wanted to go in, and he had his direction, and for the best of both shows, you amicably decided to go your own ways.
Yeah, you guys are buds. That's the important takeaway. And can you tell us a little bit about your podcast that is now on the Crawlspace Media Podcast Network that is called Unforbidden Truth?
Yeah, so Unforbidden Truth is somewhat similar to Criminal Perspective, except I tend to focus more on the criminals. More than, professionals, so on and so forth. I do have professionals on every once in a while, but my main, I guess you could say, thing that I've done over the years, 11 years now, is, criminals, murderers to be specific. I believe I have close to 30 interviews up right now. I actually just released part one of a four-part interview yesterday with South Carolina serial killer Todd Culhepp, double child murderer Charlene Dorsey, Michael Hughes, he's a serial killer on San Quentin's death row. William Dennis, he dressed up in a werewolf mask and went and killed his pregnant ex-wife, slashed her stomach with, I believe it was like a, I'm blanking on what it was, but he basically popped.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Well, let me ask you before you go on, where does this desire come from in you to speak with these people?
The desire, I guess it goes back to ever since I was little. I was always interested in, horror to be, starting my path out. I when I was like 2, 3 years old, I was watching Chucky and Jason, Freddy, so on and so forth. And ever since I could read a book, I was interested in true crime. And actually, Chris Duet was the one that actually got me, into writing serial killers. I never realized that you could write, convicted criminals, murderers. And I picked up a pen one day, and the first person I wrote was the first person I visited, which was Philip Jablonski. And once I got a letter back from Phil, it almost came like an addiction. Like I just wanted to write and talk to as many serial killers at that point in time, as possible. And, then I got letters from Manson, people like Terry Blair and just Robert Yates. And it went from, wanting to write them, talk about general stuff, to, basically digging into their mind, what came about for you to, do these horrible things. Like how, I want to know, how can somebody go rape and kill somebody, then right afterwards, have a sandwich and go out to dinner with their family? Like Culhepp said, he just got done killing 4 people at the bike shop, and his mom invited him to IHOP, and he was like, free dinner, why not? That's just mind blowing to me that somebody can go out and kill 4 people, then go out to dinner in a couple hours. Like, you know, he just had a regular day like it was nothing.
You know, it's impressive to me that you can put yourself in that position where you know it's going to get dark because you sort of raised yourself on horror movies and read horror books and you know the dark world of it, but that's fiction. But you still know the dark world of it. And then you also understand the reality of it when you say, I can't wrap my head around how someone could do that and then want to take their mom up on the offer of free dinner. How that those two, I guess, ways of being alive, those two consciousnesses can exist in one person. Were you nervous going into it, or was it did the adrenaline maybe stifle the nerves a little bit when you were getting those letters back and arranging to meet with these people and speak with them?
At first, honestly, I was kind of nervous because when I first started this 11 years ago, I was having mail. You know, I didn't have a P.O. box. I was writing for my mom's address. So I was kind of nervous then, and my mom was kind of nervous then. So about a year in, I got a P.O. box because I started writing to people, you know, like gangsters, people from the cartel, so on and so forth. And mom wasn't having that. So I had to get my own P.O. box. And I should mention my dad was a cop for like 20, 25 years. At one point, he was a homicide detective, and, you know, he has stories for days. And I guess part of that is what, you know, inspired me to want to reach out to criminals as well, because my dad, you know, spent 20, 25 years arresting and putting away, you know, rapists, murderers. He worked child cases for a while. So that actually has a little bit to do with how I got into this as well.
Very cool. And do you meet these people too? Do you physically go to these places and meet them, or is most of this done over the phone?
Most of it's done over the phone, but there are people that I have visited. For instance, I've visited, Philip Jablonski, Jack Spillman, Wesley Shermantine, John Rubio, David Wood. I'm supposed to visit the Hillside Strangler once COVID is done, Kenneth Bianchi. Trying to think, Amanda Taylor, I guess I video visited a few times. I'm blanking on who else I've, I guess David Conley, he's a mass murderer on trial in Texas. I think he's still on trial. He's been in jail for close to 10 years, killed 6 kids, 2 adults. And I'm trying to think of who else. I guess Aaron Yarba before he was convicted, the Seattle Pacific University shooter. And I plan on visiting, a few more people once COVID is done, Richard Allen Davis and Michael Hughes and a few other guys on the row in San Quentin, as well as Bruce Davis of the Manson family. I've been meaning to visit him for a couple of years, but yeah, so I plan on resuming visits once COVID's done. And I visited, I don't know, probably 6-7 serial killers so far and growing to the list.
Very interesting. And your father had a career in law enforcement, but I don't believe you have a career in law enforcement. How do you arrange these meetings, and you have to clear it with the wardens, or how does that work when you're arranging them?
So believe it or not, it's as simple as, hey, call me at this time, you know, hit record on Audacity and then we're good to go. I've never really run into any problems with wardens or any institutions for that matter. Now, if you're a part of the media, you can set up special arrangements, you know, you could get like a 4 or 5 hour call, or you could get, you know, a special visit set up where you can bring in a recorder or a video camera, so on or so forth. But it's as easy as just saying, hey, call me at this time and date and we'll do this.
Are these folks polite? Do they ever yell at you? Do they ever get mad for any reason?
I guess, believe it or not, a lot of them are very respectful and nice. I've only had a couple inmates that have gone off on me. Usually it's the ones that aren't really, you know, mentally stable. I know how to deal with those people as well. You know, I deal with psychopaths for a living. So, you know, I had dealt with Jose Martinez, El Mano Negra, threatening to kill me, you know, probably 12 different ways. You know, we'll shoot you, we'll hang you, whatever. So I'm anything that anybody wants to throw at me, I'm a pretty calm and laid back person, and I can pretty much take what you throw at me.
I guess you have to be a pretty calm and laid back person when you've put yourself in these situations. What's it like when you go to visit them? When you go to visit a Philip Jablonski, what's that like? from like driving up to the prison to actually sitting down and seeing him for the first time?
It's surreal. So the scariest experience I had was Texas death row, because they literally, you pull up, you step out of the vehicle, they search your entire vehicle, they pat you down before going into the prison, then they pat you again going into the prison. And then once you get past security, they pat you down for a third time. So it could be pretty intimidating. Like for instance, 10 years ago, I went to visit a spree killer here in Washington with my mom. Because believe it or not, my mom went with me. And when we went, my mom was scared shitless. But I was like, I don't know, 18 or 19 years old. And I was like, this is kind of crazy. This is surreal. You know, when you sit down face to face the first time, it's really awkward, you know, because it's like, okay, like say you and I met for the first time, like that's pretty normal meeting. But this guy who killed 5, 6, 7 women, it's like, you know, nice to meet you. You know, there's no real normal way to go about it. And it's just like, everybody always asks me, like, you know, I'm going to visit somebody, what should I do? I'm like, just go with the flow. Don't, almost like with a rabid pit bull, don't show fear.
What happens if you do show fear?
Well, I showed fear one time with Jack Spillman, and I think he ate it up. You can see in the photos I took with him, he put his arm around my arm, and I was just kind of standing there like, you know, like, don't touch me. And I told Jack, I made the mistake of telling him, you're the only serial killer that I'm really, you know, creeped out by or whatever. And that's probably why he would go on to brag about his crimes and death. I won't really talk about it because it involved 2 children. But when I showed fear, he basically ate it up and made me feel as uncomfortable as I possibly could.
What was it that made you say that to him? Because I feel like you operate under a pretty strict code of keeping your composure so you don't open yourself up like that. What was it that he did, and what was it that you responded with that made that happen?
Well, after he touched me, it made me really uncomfortable because he tried to put his arm around me. And that was the very first thing that made me uncomfortable. And the second thing, he was talking about his crimes. You know, if you're familiar with that case, it's, you know, the crime scene photos are out there. It's a terrible, terrible case. I won't say what he told me, but he basically told me that the reason he did what he did at his crime scene was to basically shock investigators and get a sick kick out of knowing that these guys were going there to be traumatized for the rest of their life. And everything that he said was just shocking, you know, from claims of like bestiality to being in a relationship, a consensual relationship with like a 9 or 10 year old girl, just everything under the sun he could say I'm assuming he knew would get under my skin, you know. But that's like a really rare case, Spillman, because I haven't had anybody else ever that I've been, you know, afraid of or intimidated by, even the guys that are so much taller than me. You know, like I visited Chester Turner, who's a Hoover Crip. You know, they were segregated. It was all the gang members on one side, and, you know, there's these Crips and Bloods, and just like this scrawny white dude walking past all these guys. But yeah, I mean, that was with Spillman.
Now, I wonder if you've ever been asked this question, because we keep asking you about the creepiest thing and the, you know, the most intimidating. And I'm now curious, who's the nicest one? Who's the one that you went into and you were like, oh, damn, that's a good dude?
Honestly, I'd say John Rubio. And when I went there, I was expecting, okay, this is going to be some like hardcore killer. And then as soon as we got there, he brought his comic books to visitation. And the whole time he was showing me his comic books and giggling and just like almost like a little kid, like, and he was so respectful, so nice, you know, and that just really caught me off guard. This guy that killed his 3 kids, and he explained to me, he thought they were possessed and everything. Yeah, he still believes that was the case. And, you know, but he was the nicest inmate, you know, that I've ever come across. And it just kind of blew my mind, honestly. The crimes were committed March 11th, 2003, and he was arrested that same day, and he's on death row in Texas right now.
You sort of mentioned earlier that there seemed to be a difference between talking with serial killers and other kinds of killers. Can you unpack that a little bit?
The serial killers that admit guilt, they're all about, you know, wanting to get off on it, so on and so forth. And that's, you know, that's typical for serial killers, but somebody like Dande Muniz Mascara. I don't know how you say his name, but he was Pablo Escobar's right-hand man. Like the more like gangsters and cartels, so on and so forth, they're more, believe it or not, like remorseful, and they're the more respectful ones. They'll never ask me for money, quote unquote, stand up criminals, if you would, you know, and they never want to speak about their crimes. You know, what I did was terrible. One guy was telling me, you know, we were growing up in poverty. I dropped out of school to help my family, so on and so forth. I started killing for Pablo to, you know, basically make sure my family wouldn't be poor like all the other people in Colombia were, so on and so forth. The serial killers are more into playing mind games, you know, and basically just trying to make you as uncomfortable as you possibly can. Now, there's a lot of them that claim they're innocent, even though there's, you know, DNA, five eyewitnesses, and every single traffic camera puts you at the crime scene. But that's another story.
So how do you balance that then when someone's obviously lying about it?
Well, for instance, like I'll be interviewing this guy next week, this really high profile case. This 3-year-old girl was and he claims up and down he was not there. He didn't do it, even though his wife, you know, saw him do it, saw him kick her in the head and so on and so forth. So when he does that, I'll be basically bringing up the testimony of his ex-wife, the testimony of her family, you know, well, what about this? Your ex-wife says you did this and your ex-wife said you did that. Basically, just counteracting everything that they want to say. Now, I'm not sandbagging any of these individuals by any means, but I want to, you know, basically counteract, you know, I'm innocent. Okay, well, tell me why you're innocent. You know, and I don't just go on it. It's simple as I'm innocent. Okay, well, let's talk about X, Y, and Z. These were in your court papers. Can you explain this away, and this away? And, you know, a lot of the time they'll either stumble over their words or they've been practicing it for 20, 30, 40 years and they have it down to the T.
Is there anything that would happen during the course of the interview where you realize you're getting a gut sense that you shouldn't bring this up, that you shouldn't maybe challenge their proclamation that they're innocent?
I haven't had that yet. There's one serial killer that I was going to interview that Piers Morgan talked to that basically is turned off from talking to everybody and anybody. And when I tried to speak to him about his saying that he's innocent, he hung up on me when I simply asked about clarification. Lorenzo Gilliard, that's who I'm talking about. I was asking him for clarification about certain things in his cases. And he got pretty upset and hung up on me, and he blocked me on JPay for that matter. So that's the only individual, and he didn't scream at me or anything. He just literally, this call is, it's like, thank you for using Global Telling. He hung up on me and haven't heard from him since. So I haven't really dealt with anybody that's, you know, got too defensive or, you know, whatever, other than that one case.
Okay, and we have a couple of clips that you provided us. One of them is from Wild Bill. Can you tell us a little bit about this guy?
Yeah, so Wild Bill is an American serial killer that was living in Panama. He was a fugitive, and from what he says, there's a lot of American fugitives over there. Actually, he killed a family that were fugitives, and he claims that his a few of his other victims were fugitives. And I met, believe it or not, I met Wild Bill through Facebook. No, prisons don't have internet access or whatever, and you're not supposed to have a phone, but being that it's Panama, you can get, from the sounds of it, grenades, AK-47s. So cell phones are really nothing in a prison. But he killed five American, I guess they're called expats in Panama. And he was sentenced to 47 years in prison, which is astounding considering, you know, the laws here in America. You know, you kill one person, it's, you know, especially with how he did it, he would either be sentenced to death or, you know, life in prison. But Wild Bill, his case is pretty interesting, being that, for one, he used a gun, and two, all of his victims were, you know, American. They weren't Panamanian, whatever. And he's made a lot of claims over the course of the last month I've been speaking to him about corruption in Panama. Like, for instance, he said after he was arrested, they stole like $196,000 from him, and he paid them that, thinking that his wife at the time was going to be released. There's a lot of, Wild Bill is interesting in itself, because When I first spoke to him, he was like, don't call me a serial killer. You know, I hate that word. I'm not a piece of shit like all these other guys, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, you kill five people, Bill. You know, surely that's got to amount to something.
Yeah, I'm curious about his, he's sort of a political activist, and he was part of, or he organized what could appear to be a sort of like a really controversial, like right-wing or conservative organization called the Southern National Patriots. And then you say that he wanted you to make sure that he wasn't addressed as a serial killer. Do you think that he sees himself as more like a freedom fighter?
He sees himself more, I think, as like a vigilante killer.
Okay.
He'll call himself a hitman more than a serial killer. And, you know, he's like, he'll say he took over their properties, you know, the first time I spoke to him, he's like, you know, I would have never killed anybody hadn't it been for my own greed. And there's laws in Panama where apparently if you're living at someone's property and they're no longer, they're not there to fight you on claiming their property, their property is now, you know, yours. So that's what he was doing with these individuals. He basically killed them, took over their properties, you know, airplanes, boats, so on and so forth. So, which is almost kind of like a Black Widow, if you think about it. You know, that's what Black Widows, you know, do, kill for financial gain, which makes his case a little more interesting, especially being that he's an American, you know, living in Panama, and his victims were all American for that fact. But and he's also a preacher at the prison too. He has his own, you know, fellowship there, and he's looked up to as he refers to himself as Prophet Bill, Brother Bill.
All right, and we're going to play that clip right now.
It's a strange market here in Latin America. I'm super famous, man. I mean, like, there isn't a household here that doesn't know if you showed a picture, who's that? That's Wild Bill. It's not like you wake up one morning when your kid says, I'm going to be a contract killer when I grow up. And that's not how it works. It's one step after another step down into hell. It's weird for me to be thought of as a serial killer. I don't think of myself in that way at all. And like, what I come to mind to me when you talk about a serial killer is a guy like Ted Bundy, or, you know, people who kill for like gratification, or, you know, for, because they like it. I was just what I did was for money.
You want to see a criminal? I'm going to give you the best damn criminal there is.
You know, Lance, a while back, I started looking for a matching puzzle game that could give me a good challenge, something requiring more than the same basic strategy round after round. But the more I searched, the more I wondered if I'd ever find what I was looking for. And you know, we've talked about this ad nauseum off air.
We really have, because you came across Best Fiends, and Best Fiends is the mobile puzzle game that always leaves your brain feeling refreshingly challenged. And you, sir, have really exceeded in your levels of conquering Best Fiends. What are you at now?
I don't really know, Lance. I just know that playing Best Fiends makes me feel like my brain just got a deep tissue massage. Yeah. You know, it makes me feel like I just I took a few laps in the pool and I'm just refreshed. I'm ready to go, ready to get at the next part of my day.
Well, Tim, just like taking a ride around the block on your bike or swimming a few laps, you have a lot of fun doing that. You have a lot of fun with Best Fiends. I mean, is it too much fun for you?
I wouldn't say too much. It's probably just the right amount of fun. But it is way more fun than other matching puzzle games. You know, the ones where all you do is smash candy over and over. Best Fiends is not repetitive like that. It literally has thousands of fun puzzles to solve. I'm already on level 4,396, Lance.
And these levels never get old, Tim. They're always introducing new characters or new themes. Is there anything new that popped up for you that caught your eye and you thought to yourself, well, how do they do this?
It's just the way it makes me feel, Lance. It makes me feel refreshed and like I've learned, I've exercised my brain, and I can dive back in and do my other daily tasks. I love Best Fiends, Lance, and you can download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends for free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That is Friends, drop the R, so no R there. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Hey y'all, my name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a journalist and producer, and I'm the host of Unjust and Unsolved, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, Murder in Alliance, a real-time investigation into a case that is so bonkers, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Everyone in this town seems to have some kind of secret or interest in this victim, whether it be drugs, sex, or both.
I'll be teaming up with Jason Baldwin from the West Memphis 3 and his organization Proclaim Justice to reinvestigate this murder from the ground in Ohio.
If he slit her throat right here, there would be more blood on that
sofa.
We track down witnesses.
You guys have got to understand what's at risk for me here.
And even uncover massive police corruption.
There were two officers that felt like their brotherhood, their staff, that could have been involved.
This is the case of David Thorne and the murder of Yvonne Lane. Find and follow Murder and Alliance wherever you get your podcasts.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
And we have another clip from your interview, part one of your interview with Todd Kohlhepp. Can you tell us about that individual?
Todd's convicted of murdering seven people. And, you know, he's more, you know, infamous for the kidnapping of Kayla Brown. She was, you know, you can find it on YouTube. From 2003 throughout 2016, Todd killed seven individuals. And of course, everybody knows about the infamous bike shop killings. You know, he killed four individuals after they had laughed at him, you know, about not being able to ride the bike. It's more deep than that. And he'll explain that on part two of our interview. But Todd is one of the more, I hate to say it, but he's quote unquote more a normal serial killer than anybody I've ever spoke to. During the second part of our interview, I had asked him, you know, can we talk about the murders in chronological order, starting with your first confirmed murders? And then he says, would you like to talk about the first confirmed murders or would you like to talk about the first murders? And that kind of caught me off guard. And I said something like, if you're comfortable, we can talk about the first murders. Because it totally caught me off guard and nothing really shocks me, you know. And I was aware that he has made claims in the past about killing two individuals and the cops never really took him serious. Or I guess he claims that they did take him serious, but they didn't listen to him, and they basically ended the search early. And he'll explain all that in the interview. He told them to, you know, maybe look here, but not here. And from the sounds of it, they weren't listening to him, and they were looking at the places where he said that the bodies wouldn't be. But then maybe they might be here, or yes, it's here. Then they just completely combed over the area.
His intelligence level was pretty high, correct?
Oh, yeah, I'd say so. Compared to a lot of serial killers, I'd say he's very intelligent. I mean, making $500,000 a year, you got to be pretty bright to do that.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he impressed the people around him with his intelligence. And was there any moment during your interviews with him that you thought that you might be a little bit out of your league? Like, I'm only asking that because you said that you don't get shocked by a lot of things. And his comment about the victims that he hasn't been charged with, kind of took you aback. Do you think that was his way of saying to you that you should know your place, and I think I'm smarter than you, and you should feel like you're not in my world? Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. I think it was more of being cocky on his part more than anything. The only things that really shocked me throughout the interview is how he spoke about some of his victims. And it's no secret that Todd, very not so sensitive towards his victims, especially in regards to Kayla Brown. There's letters out there that people have posted about him, you know, just nonstop bashing her, and you know, she's the one I should have killed, so on and so forth. And he'll speak a lot about her throughout the interview. But that's the only thing that really shocked me. But of course, I knew going into this how Todd felt about his victims. But I know that'll shock a lot of people as well. But that's the only thing that really, the first two murders kind of caught me off guard. But everything else was kind of like, okay, I know that's how Todd is. Just kind of roll with it.
Did you have a best friend growing up?
I had one friend that I thought he was a close friend, and then he ended up shooting my dog with a BB gun, and then I got blamed for shooting the dog with a BB gun. I'm not the one who shot him. He did. So when I got blamed for it, once I got ungrounded, I went across the street and beat his ass, and then I tried to kill him. He ended up being he liked to huff and you know, paint, thinner, all that kind of stuff. And I found some really caustic stuff in the garage and gave it to him with the intent of him going ahead and huffing it and pretty much hope he died from it. At the end of it, I don't know what he did, but I ran into him 2 years later and he was a walking vegetable. So I guess it worked. But that's about as close as I had to a friend. I had one in Arizona that was a friend and somebody shot him. So it wasn't me. Some wannabe gang initiate, whatever, drove by and shot him one day trying to, I don't know. So I wasn't involved.
Well, what else is coming up on Unforbidden Truth?
So I'm working on a lot right now. Next month will be Terry Hobbs. That'll be a two-part interview. If you guys are familiar with the West Memphis 3 case, you know, Damian Echols, Jason Baldwin, Jesse Miskelly, Terry Hobbs is the stepfather of Stevie Branch. And of course, everybody knows that Terry Hobbs was almost crucified, you know, in the, I want to say it was the third movie, the Paradise Lost movie, the new evidence came about. I believe there was a hair of Terry's found in one of the ligatures. That's probably one of the more interesting interviews I've done recently, because he's not convicted of murder. And a lot of what he says is really cringeworthy. Like, for instance, I asked him about when he broke his ex-wife's jaw, and he just kind of laughed it off, and, you know, just kind of like, well, you'd have to ask her about that. And the shooting of her brother at the time, he just, I don't know, kind of laughs about it. And there's an incident involving him and John Mark Byers where he claims that Byers went to his house threatening to kill him, and police went to his house, and they had to de-escalate the situation between him and Byers. I also have an interview coming out soon with Wayne Lowe, a Massachusetts school shooter, happened almost 30 years ago. Brian Dugan, a serial killer out of Illinois, he killed three individuals that are confirmed. He claims he was molested by John Wayne Gacy back in the day. I'm working on securing a few more big interviews. I don't want to jinx it yet. I probably have 50 people waiting on me. And the good thing about inmates is they have nothing but time on their hands, and they're very understanding, you know, when it comes to, I guess, putting them off for a while.
And would you ever dispute the fact that your relationship with Chris Duet is like Rocky and Apollo Creed, and you guys will get into that bout at one point?
No.
Okay. Historically speaking, who would be the one that you'd always want to? Who's the one that you'd want to go to for an interview, for a sit down interview? Living or dead, historically speaking, who's like your dream interview?
I'd say Carl Panzram or Cora Watts. It'd have to be either or both, for that matter.
You know what's great is that, like, I think I have to look that up. I think I have to Google that, and you're such an expert in this that those just came right to the top of your head. Like, those are the ones that you'd want. And I think some people would think, like, well, maybe H.H. Holmes or something like that. But you go for the serious ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, H.H. Holmes would be a good one too. But, you know, I think those two guys are the ones that I'd be curious to talk to the most. I was like 10 or 11, I think, when Watts died, so there was no chance of speaking to him whatsoever.
Which one would you like to punch in the face the most?
Jack Spillman, without a doubt.
Tim was talking about between me or him.
Oh, I guess you guys would have to rock, paper, scissors that.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.